From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. When a fringe conservative movement calling itself the Tea Party won big in the last national election, it took a lot of people by surprise. The Republican Party was supposed to be weak and ideologically confused. So, what happened?
We're thinking of having a Chicago Tea Party in July. All you capitalists that want to show up to Lake Michigan, I'm going to start organizing.
The rant heard round the world from Rick Santelli. Today, the making of a conservative movement, from the emergence of the first Tea Party activist to the persuasive power of Ronald Reagan.
Both sides of the aisle, there's a kind of nostalgia for Reagan that allows us to imagine him coming back and giving speeches in a way that neither Democrat or Republican could do today.
And family ties as proof that conservatives ruled the 80s.
Every time one of these ex-hippies comes prancing in from yesteryear, we got to get out the love beats.
Kelly Carinder is a Seattle-area blogger considered by many to be the very first Tea Party activist. She's come a long way. In her first attempt at political organizing just a few years ago, she held a protest in Seattle in response to the amount of government spending. It drew, maybe 120 people. Today, her mailing list is in the thousands. She's been embraced by conservative leaders and even flown to Washington for training as a conservative activist. Carinder is a good poster child for the diversity of the new conservative movement. She's young, body-pierced, and passionate about bringing her economic ideals into politics. Carinder told Steve Paulson what the first protests were like.
I mean, they were amazing because there's so many of us across the nation that just never spoke out, never protested, sort of thought that our civic duty revolved around elections rather than in between elections, keeping politicians accountable and trying to influence policy. And so these first few protests were these amazing moments of finding like-minded people, especially if you're in a place like I am, that is very not known for its, it's not very known for its conservative leanings.
You're in Seattle.
Right. And Seattle is a very, very liberal town. So finding other people who were like-minded was this great moment, and knowing that you're not alone and that there are other people who do think like you. So that was fantastic. So that's how they used to be. And I would say they've changed a lot because people no longer feel completely out of the loop. I mean, believe me, we still feel like there are so many things that are still wrong, and there's so many politicians on the left and the right that have no regard for the citizenry. But we do feel like we've got a little foot in the door.
Is this all just about economics? Is it about trying to limit government spending?
Yeah. So I affiliate with Tea Party Patriots. There's a few different umbrella groups. The one I affiliate with and work for is Tea Party Patriots. And we have three guiding principles: fiscal responsibility, constitutionally limited government, and free markets. So it very much is an economic movement.
So a lot of the traditional causes that Republicans rally around, especially the social issues like protesting the right to an abortion or gay marriage, those are not important issues to you.
No, because first of all, there's so many other groups that deal with social issues on either side of the issue. They're very well established, they're well funded. So we basically say, look, if you want to get involved in something like abortion, there's tons of groups out there on either side that you can get involved with. There wasn't really a movement, though, or a group that really dealt with these economic issues from our point of view. And those issues are so divisive that, you know, at any given Tea Party meeting, you'll have two people sitting next to each other that, you know, one is very pro-choice and one is very pro-life. And then you'll have two people working together on a Tea Party protest, one who supports gay marriage and one who is vehemently against it. So these issues, these economic issues, unite people in such a phenomenal way that, and like I said, there's other groups that deal with those other issues. You can't be everything to everyone. You know, you have to stay focused. And if we really want to affect policy and legislation on these economic issues, then we have to be focused on them.
So let's just play this out for a little bit. You're saying there's way too much government intervention in our lives. Too much money is being spent by the government. Very specifically, what should the government not be spending money on that it is now?
Lots of stuff. Well, let's take a look at some of the various departments. There's, you know, the Department of Agriculture. I remember I was in D.C. about a year ago, and I was driving by. I was in a cab, and I was driving by all of these buildings, building after building after building after building, with rows of cubicles and floors of cubicles. And I just thought, what do all those people do? And one of them was the Department of Agriculture. I think we need to be very judicious in these departments. Department of Education. Like, what does the Department of Education do? I understand that you know, we spend money on education, but it doesn't, you know, I'm not against public education, but what does the Department of Education actually do? So I would first, you know, I would want to take a look at the various departments, commissions, agencies, boards. I know the GAO put out a study. There's over $200 billion of redundancies across these various boards and commissions and agencies and things like that. So that sort of thing I'd like to stop spending money on.
Well, just to take this as an example, presumably the U.S. Education Department studies educational policy. It studies what makes for effective teaching and ineffective teaching. It works on standardized tests. The mission is to try to have some overall standards for what makes good schooling around the country. You're saying those are not important issues?
Well, I'm saying that those issues could also partially be done at the state level. It's not the federal government's job to run education, and different states need different things. I also think if you look at the size of the Department of Education, if you're really just going to have one little commission that sort of studies what's effective education, what's not, and that sort of thing, I don't think you need an entire department. So maybe we don't get rid of the Department of Education. Maybe we scale it down to the size that it really should be, which would save us a lot of money. And the same thing for the Department of Agriculture, you know, and these various departments that maybe we need a very small agency that studies some things. It just seems, you know, our regulatory agencies are huge because they have to be to keep up with all of these onerous rules and regulations. I would also go very far in saying that one of the projects we're working on right now is the healthcare compact, and that is an effort to completely remove healthcare from the federal government and bring it back to the states. The federal government would still be spending money, but it would basically be completely block granted to the states with no strings attached. A lot of people, when they talk about block grants, there's still strings attached. We're talking about completely free to spend the money on healthcare the way that the state wants to. So Vermont, for instance, could become a single payer state if they wanted to. And a state like Texas could try out free market reforms.
So whenever possible, you would like to bring the control of all kinds of governmental decisions to the state level, take it out of federal hands.
Yeah. And the reason is because, you know, for me, it takes me a little just over an hour to get to my state capital. There and back is less than a tank of gas for me. I can visit my legislators. I can go to the governor's office. You know, I can go to hearings. I can actually testify at a hearing on a piece of legislation. For me in Seattle to get to D.C., say, to testify, which I'm sure I wouldn't even be able to testify, you know, would be a day there, a day back in travel, hundreds of dollars. My U.S. representatives represent way more, you know, hundreds of thousands of more people than my state rep represents. So I have a bigger voice. We all have a much bigger voice, the smaller, the closer the decision making gets to the people. So what we want is to look at every single policy choice and ask the question, who decides? Who should decide that question? If it's education or healthcare, you know, or agriculture or environmental or whatever it is, at what level should that decision be made? And I think in every case, where it's possible, bring it as close to the people as possible. Again, how much easier is it for us to go to a school board meeting and have an effect on the school policy there than it is to go to D.C. and to try to talk to somebody at Department of Education who's probably not going to care who you are at all? And make sure that most of the decisions that are being made by elected people so that we can hold them accountable. Because the bigger government gets, especially at the federal level, the more the decisions are made by bureaucrats that have no accountability to the people at all. So closer to the people and made by folks who are elected rather than appointed or hired.
Now, there have been a lot of political movements over the course of history in America, and a number of them burn out after a few years, maybe after sort of the initial sort of popular outrage has worn off. What's your sense of the future of the Tea Party?
Well, I'm an optimist, first of all. But second, you know, I've heard a lot of people say, well, I haven't seen that many people at protests lately. I'm worried. What's going on? And I travel the country a lot and I meet with local groups a lot. You're not seeing a lot of the Tea Party out in the streets because they're working. They're going to these meetings. Some of them are running for local offices. They at least have a monthly group meeting, if not weekly. They're really involved in their local communities. So there obviously is always a chance that people are going to burn out. And I do think that after the election, people put so much into building up to the election that there are some people I know that have said, look, I'm going to take the next few months off, then I'll get back involved maybe, you know, summertime 2011. So there are some people that, you know, you do get burnt out. It's basically a volunteer-based movement. So you really run the risk of burnout with volunteers. But I've never met so many people that are so committed to an ideal. And I think it's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing to see people turn away from being committed to a person or a politician, because I think on both sides of the aisle, we've had that for way too long. And then because we're committed to that person or that politician, we look the other way when they make mistakes and when they do not keep their promises or when they're corrupt. And I think to be committed rather than to a person, to an ideal, you can hold those people accountable. And you have, it's such a bigger view than a person. So I think because of that, we have a very good chance of sustaining for quite a long time.
Do you think the Republican Party has more or less taken on Tea Party values, or do you still see a disjunction between the Republican establishment and the Tea Party movement?
I think there is still a gap between not only the Republican establishment, and it's going to sound, but the Democratic establishment too. I mean, obviously the Democrats have a big problem with the Tea Party ideals, but what I'm trying to say is I think there is this establishment of people in both parties who don't want to rock the boat. You know, Nancy Pelosi said something about how she wished elections didn't matter so much, meaning what she was saying was she wished that the two parties could be closer again instead of Republicans being off, you know, being pulled off into this Tea Party path, that if they were just closer together, it would be easier to govern. And, you know, and so I think there's actually a lot of Republicans at the top that think like that as well. It's scary to take a stand for something and have the press come after you. And, you know, you have to know your stuff. You have to be able to defend your beliefs and defend them rationally. And so there's definitely still a gap. A lot of us are starting to feel like, you know, this isn't a Democrat versus Republican fight anymore. We feel like it's the people versus a ruling elite who think that they know better than us. And some of them are Democrats, some of them are Republicans, but they think they know how to run our lives better than we do. And that's what we're fighting against.
Kelly Carinder is considered the first Tea Partier. She blogs and organizes in Seattle, Washington. Steve Paulson spoke with her.
How about this, President and new administration? Why don't you put up a website to have people vote on the internet as a referendum to see if we really want to subsidize the losers' mortgages, or would we like to at least buy cars and buy houses in foreclosure and give them to people that might have a chance to actually prosper down the road and reward people that could carry the water instead of drink the water?
Hey, Rick,
that's a novel idea.
Hey, Rick, did you?
What? Who thought of that? Yeah.
Rick, I congratulate you on your new incarnation as a revolutionary leader.
Somebody needs one. I'll tell you what, if you read our founding fathers, people like Benjamin Franklin and Jefferson, what we're doing in this country now is making them roll over in their graves.
Rick Santelli's so-called rant heard round the world packed a lot of punch, in part because Santelli conjured some of the most potent references in American culture, the Founding Fathers and the Boston Tea Party. Jill Lepore teaches American history at Harvard and writes for The New Yorker. She says that the Founding Fathers are a hot commodity for Democrats and Republicans alike. In her new book, The Whites of Their Eyes, The Tea Party's Revolution and the Battle Over American History, Lepore does a reality check on Tea Party claims to the Founding Fathers. She told Anne Strainchamps about the moment they entered the Tea Party picture.
Well, if you remember, Barack Obama was inaugurated in January of 2009, and just a few weeks later, cable news financial reporter Rick Santelli delivered what came to be called, within hours, and sort of went viral on the internet, the rant around the world. He was delivering a really early morning broadcast from the floor of Chicago Stock Exchange and kind of lost it talking about the stimulus package and the bailout. And it was a very kind of strange crowd behind him of brokers kind of getting ready to start their work day. And people started cheering as he kind of ranted on and on and on about how un-American it was and that Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson were rolling over in their graves at the idea that the government would pay your neighbor's mortgage. Or, you know, there's this kind of weird conflation of what the stimulus package even did. Or just generally the economic policies of the latter end of the Bush administration and the beginning of the Obama administration. And Santelli called for Americans to, he said, we could dump tea into Lake Michigan here in Chicago. We need a new tea party.
When it comes to the Founding Fathers and the original Boston Tea Party and the politics of the 1770s, there's not much that you don't know. And as an historian, this is your field. You know, just to run through a few of the Tea Party's claims, a major Tea Party analogy has been this idea of taxation without representation. I mean, how does that actually hold up?
So that's a slogan that dates really from 1765, when the British Parliament imposed the Stamp Act on American colonies, a new sort of stamp tax. And Boston colonists in particular wrote eloquently about the need for the colonists to be represented in Parliament in order for Parliament to levy this kind of tax. There had been taxes before, but this was a different kind of tax. And so that is an important claim in the 18th century, and it is a big part of how American colonists who later, you know, fight for independence think about the nature of their struggle. How that has anything to do with the Tea Party's claim in 2009 that, say, healthcare reform was a violation of the principles of the American Revolution is hard to say, given that voter turnout in the election in 2008, for instance, was higher than in any American presidential election since 1968. So there it was a great deal of political representation in 2008 and 2009. Moreover, we live in an age of essentially universal suffrage. And in the 18th century, what those colonists were struggling for was for the right of men, white men who owned property, to have a role in their own government. That's a very small percentage of the population today. And so there's just the analogy is completely cockamamie.
Right, so
I mean, there's a spirit to it that makes sense. But by any metric, you can't argue that we live in an age without representation today.
What about the other really common claim that the U.S. was founded on the basis of Christianity? You've had a number of prominent conservatives making that point lately, that the U.S. was intended by the Founding Fathers to be a Christian nation.
A lot of these claims are years in coming. There's a long backstory behind each of these claims. There are a couple more pieces of it. I mean, we could maybe identify four. So one is this notion of taxation without representation. The other is a Christian nation. The third would be that the revolution was fought to establish free markets. It's a common claim that's made by the far right. And the fourth would be that the Founding Fathers established the Constitution as a kind of holy writ, as a kind of revealed religion that was kind of incorruptible. Each of these claims has antecedents in American history. There have been other times and places where, for political reasons, people have put forth these arguments. They simply do not accord with the archival evidence when you study the 18th century and look at the lives of ordinary people in particular. And part of the distortion is this group of people to whom we confine all of our discussions. So we talk about the Founding Fathers. Well, the Founding Fathers is itself that phrase was coined by Warren Harding, you know, in 1921, when he was trying to sort of suggest that he was the next founding father, that his presidency was divinely inspired. So even sort of the invention of the idea that there is this small set of people who have this particular political authority and historical authority that trumps anything that anyone else who ever lived in the 18th century had to say is itself a political argument.
Right. I mean, didn't Tom Paine say religion, he thought, was something to the effect that religion was a bad idea?
Yeah, I mean, there's this weird sloppiness. You know, if Paine said something that's useful to your political argument, people will quote Paine, and people on the far right will quote Paine, you know, often only really quoting from Common Sense, which he wrote in 1776. But of course, Common Sense was the first in what Paine considered really a trilogy of books, going on to write The Rights of Man and The Age of Reason. And The Age of Reason is an extended argument against organized and institutional religion of any kind. Paine, you know, famously said, "My own mind is my own church." I mean, he just completely opposed organized religion in any form and thought that an established religion and a relationship between the church and the state was the greatest form of all tyranny. And Jefferson believed this too. There's a beautiful passage in Jefferson's first inaugural address where, having gained the presidential office after a campaign in which Adams supporters said the choice at the ballot box was between Jefferson and no God or God and John Adams, you know, Jefferson got up there and said, you know, we have gained nothing if we have given up religious despotism for political despotism that is equally as absolute.
And they debated this amongst themselves. Didn't John Adams then in turn sort of accuse Thomas Jefferson of being an atheist?
Yeah, although, you know, John Adams' own views on religion were very complicated. I mean, he actually thought that Christianity was necessary to maintain morality, but he in some deep way didn't have a kind of belief in it that, say, later evangelicals would have in it. I mean, the point that you're getting at here, which is very hard for people to necessarily hold in their heads in the kind of soundbite culture, but the 18th century was an age of tremendous intellectual ferment, right? I mean, people are coming up with whole new ways of thinking about the relationship between people and their rulers, really wrestling in a way that hadn't been wrestled with since, you know, the great philosophical debates of antiquity. People really deeply, profoundly wondering, how do we govern ourselves and one another, and what are the rights that we have as human beings? So there's nothing but disagreement. There can be no great debate without a tremendous amount of disagreement. And what we have now, of course, in this weird, freaky bumper sticker culture that we live in, like if you think about what Google does, Google, it's like a decontextualizing machine. Like if you wanted to invent something that could take anything that you or I say out of context, we would invent Google. So, you know, if you want to Google Jefferson and God or Adams and God, you can find all kinds of positions, all kinds of little snippets to support one or another position.
Right, yeah.
And if you're just, you know, posting something, blogging something, screaming something on, you know, on television, you can say, you could say you have the authority of the founding fathers to make this claim, but it's completely taken out of context. And it's the fabric of that debate, of decades of political debate, where, you know, individuals change their minds. It's not just that Jefferson and Adams disagree with one another. They change their minds over the course of their lives. These are these brilliant intellectuals. Of course they change their minds about things.
Well, and the quote-unquote founding fathers are hardly a monolith. But there's one of the really interesting points to me that you make in your book is that there's a long history in America of laying claim to various and sundry of the founding fathers, but there's something different about what the Tea Party has been doing, that there's, I think what you said is that there's something sort of religious about the way they refer to the founding fathers.
Yeah, I mean, I talk about what I call historical fundamentalism, and that's the one element of the Tea Party that troubles me. I mean, I think it really does need to be said again and again and again that most people who have been swept up in this political movement are upset about the economy, they're worried about the debt, they have all kinds of, you know, very ordinary and sympathetic political concerns, and they're expressing their political views publicly, and, you know, nothing is better, right? That's what we're here for. That's what we do. We need to debate, and we need to exercise our right to political speech. What's troubling to me is the way in which some of the elevation of this very narrow and contorted view of the 18th century to a kind of national scripture, and especially the use of the Constitution in American political life by people on the far right, is kind of an end run around the church-state separation issue. If you make history a religion, then you can bring religion into the schools. If you make history your religion, then you can bring your religion into politics. And that really troubles me. So that when people would say, you could watch on Fox News people kind of having an argument about, say, the Health Care Reform Act, which, you know, you and I might disagree about the Health Care Reform Act. We could get ourselves blue in the face arguing about it, and nothing would be more American and nothing would be more democratic than for us to disagree about it. And so long as we're having this debate and we're bringing different evidence into it in our political advantages and our own experiences, we're having a healthy and important debate. But the minute I say, let's say, I say, you know what, I think it is unconstitutional, and then we're going to have a debate about whether it's unconstitutional. That's also fine. But then if I proclaim to you that the Constitution was essentially written by God and that the Founding Fathers were divinely inspired and that the Constitution amounts to a revealed religion, then everything that you say when you disagree with me I view as a kind of heresy. And then my contempt for your belief is a kind of sickening and destabilizing and disequilibrizing force in our conversation. And that, I think, is, you know, on the margins of this movement, the kind of thing that you see, and that really does trouble me.
But I guess what I'm wondering is why the desire to treat the Constitution as a document of a revealed religion. I mean, it suggests there's some hunger for a kind of pure and stable truth.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and a very understandable one, right? Like, we are, as a people, a story. We don't really have a common history or common language, common ethnicity. We do not share a common religion. We share an idea. We share this faith in our system of government and the ideas and the ideals that were indeed established in the 18th century. For me, that idea is the idea of the constant struggle to realize the promise of those ideas. I mean, I don't think that the promise of the revolution was realized in the 18th century. I don't think it has been realized yet. What I cherish as an American is the struggle to realize that promise of equality.
Jill Lepore is a professor of American history at Harvard University and the author of The Whites of Their Eyes, The Tea Party's Revolution and the Battle Over American History. She spoke with Anne Strainchamps. Who do you think has the best claim to Founding Fathers? Let us know at our website. It's ttbook.org. You can become a Facebook fan of To the Best of Our Knowledge there, too. Just follow the link. Coming up, why Ronald Reagan still matters today as much as ever. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin Online Bachelor of Science in Sustainable Management, developing leaders with the critical skills to grow a green economy. Information is at sustain.wisconsin.edu.
If you want to build a successful political movement, conservative or liberal, one place to look for inspiration is the presidency of Ronald Reagan. Whether or not you admire his politics, Reagan is hailed as the great communicator and revered among conservatives for his powers of persuasion and for articulating difficult political positions to the American public. Julian Zelizer is a presidential historian and a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He told me why Reagan's still so relevant today.
Well, he's become a symbol to the conservative movement of conservatives coming to power and conservatives reshaping public debate in the United States. He remains the icon for the movement. He remains, the FDR of the Republican Party. And so I think that's why his staying power is so great. And we've had many myths made about him that are central still to the conservative movement.
But it wasn't just what he believed, was it? I mean, there was something about the man himself. I mean, we've talked, of course, over the years about his comfort in the office, the sweaters that he wore, his history as an actor has to have played some part in it. Was there something about his personality that made him particularly memorable?
Yeah, look, there are three parts of Ronald Reagan. There are the ideas, there are the policies, and then there's the person. And the person was very important. He was a very charismatic figure. He embodied for many Americans, even those who didn't like him, what strong leadership was. He had a comfort in front of television cameras and in front of audiences that's often lacking, even in our greatest presidents. And so I think when people remember who he was, they remember this very strong leader. And that was important in terms of what the Republican Party and what conservatism could put forward, especially after a decade of Watergate, stagflation, and before that, Vietnam.
You described him as the FDR of the conservative movement. In fact, he was a New Deal Democrat, wasn't he?
Well, yeah, he started as a Democrat, and, you know, for the early part of his life, that's the party he identified with. But very early on, by the 1940s and 1950s, he was creeping toward conservatism. So it happens pretty early in his life still.
One of the things that Reagan is credited with is that he moved the country to the right. What is it that he did to manage that?
Well, I don't know if he moved the country to the right. I think the country was moving right, and that's part of why he was elected president in 1980. A conservative movement had emerged in the 1970s. It involved everything from local activists in the South who were mobilizing voters and putting money behind candidates to new think tanks in Washington, such as the Cato Institute, that were producing ideas and policy briefs about things like tax cuts or deregulation. And what Reagan did was not only was he part of that whole movement, but he was able to articulate the ideas that they were talking about and make them look not as extreme, but as mainstream. And if he moved the country to the right, it was more that he sold and convinced more Americans that the ideas of this conservative movement were the ideas of the majority in this country. And so on many areas, from taxes to national defense, he was able to sell policies that had fallen in disfavor in the previous decades.
There were so many things that happened during his presidency, some of which, at least, he was responsible for. But I have the sense that it was the way in which he managed to articulate the conservative mission, the ideals of the conservative party, that made a difference. You talk about his speeches. I wonder if you could talk a little more in specifics about that. What was it about the way he presented the message that seemed to resonate with people?
He had an amazing ability to mix detail and even statistical information with good stories. And you can go back to 1964 when he really came to the national spotlight when he made a speech for Barry Goldwater, who was running against Lyndon Johnson. And it was a televised advertisement that looked like a speech. And he gives this amazing address in which he really just goes after all the key liberal policies, flooding the listener with data and statistics about why the welfare system doesn't work, why the tax system doesn't work, and at the same time sprinkling it with very human stories that, you know, were easy for people to understand. And I think he did that throughout his presidency. So in 1981, when he's selling this tax cut, a historic tax cut, a regressive tax cut, which benefited wealthier Americans, you know, he combined, on the one hand, arguments about supply-side economics and why reducing taxes for wealthier Americans and business was ultimately better for the whole nation, you know, with stories about himself, for example, paying very high taxes when he was an actor because the rates were at 90% after World War II. And that combination, I think, was always his most effective tool in giving speeches.
Here we are decades later, and it's almost as though he could hop onto a platform if he were around and give those same speeches again, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and the irony is, you know, many people didn't like Ronald Reagan in the 1980s. There's now this memory that, you know, liberals got along with him, all the conservatives revered him. But if you look at the newspapers, say in the mid-1980s or late 1980s, you would see You know, liberals were furious with the redistribution of wealth that took place under his presidency, with the deregulation of many industries and with a massive buildup of defense. And many conservatives didn't like him. They thought in the end he was too moderate, that he caved on tax increases. He increases taxes in 1982 and 1983. They thought he was not cautious when he made peace with Gorbachev. Many conservatives thought Gorbachev was not serious and that he was just a tool of the Kremlin. And so it was a very contentious period when he was president. But I think now that's not what people remember. On both sides of the aisle, there's a kind of nostalgia for Reagan that allows us to imagine him coming back and giving speeches in a way that neither Democrat or Republican could do today.
This is another example of the way in which Reagan is seen differently by different sides. Modern Democrats are now looking at Reagan. They seem to have adopted the idea that they should take the things he did that they would have done and point to them as ways that the country could go forward. Is there any value to Democrats in looking back to Reagan?
Sure. I mean, look, if you have an effective leader, whether he supports what you are for or he's against what you are for, there's still a value in trying to understand leadership. And, you know, it's hard to argue he wasn't a very powerful president and a president who had a lasting impact. So I think, you know, there's some merit to why a President Obama might look back at Reagan to try to understand how he persuaded the nation to support his policies, how he sometimes was able to win over Democrats who fiercely opposed what he was doing. And important for Obama, I guess, is how Reagan often went against the base of his own party. And angered them, yet in the long term became a hero to them. And so I assume all of that is relevant to a Democratic president today.
I remember Reagan quite clearly, and I remember how strong the opinions about him were. And it's hard to imagine the same man is the one that they're talking about now as they look back to Reagan as a bridge figure.
It's not the same man, and it's not the same political figure. You know, Reagan was not a unifier. He imagined himself to be, and he was able to win re-election with large majorities. But he was someone who put forth policies, really created pretty bitter debates in this country. If you asked most House Democrats in the 1980s what they thought of Reagan, they would have said, here's a president who's redistributing wealth from the middle class to the wealthy. Here's a president who is reckless in his foreign policy. Here is a president who is not taking seriously the fact that many people are not conservatives and not part of this Republican revolution. But today, that's forgotten. And so we remember a Reagan who's very different than the Reagan from that period.
Do you think Reagan changed the landscape of politics in America?
He did. Again, he was not the cause, but he did capture the ideas of a movement, and he was able to sell them politically. And so a lot of the ideas that had been circulating among conservatives, some had been fringe ideas, some had been more popular in Republican circles, he was the one who sold it to the nation. That's what a successful president could do. So he could take this idea of why reducing taxes for the wealthy and business would ultimately improve the entire nation, and he was able to sell that idea to the country, at least for a bit. He was able to sell the idea in the aftermath of Vietnam why we should place incredibly heavy investment in the defense budget and why we should build it up rapidly and dramatically, even if it increased the deficit. All of those are ideas that have stuck and remain very important. In that way, he shifted debate. He also made an argument, which we don't remember as much, about presidential power. And he was one of the conservatives who believed Congress had become too strong in the 1970s and that the executive should have a lot of power to do what was needed. And that's an idea that I think also remains very much part of our political landscape.
Julian Zelizer is a presidential historian and a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Coming up next, why one political analyst says 80s pop culture wrote the book on conservatism in America. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. You may think the war of ideas between red and blue America is a relatively recent development, but according to journalist and newspaper columnist David Sirota, the conservatives won way back in the 1980s. In his new book, Back to Our Future, Sirota says the unprecedented media conglomeration of the 80s essentially built the framework for a conservative point of view, a template we still use today. Sirota says the proof is in the staying power of 80s pop culture. He told Steve Paulson about one example, the hit sitcom Family Ties.
Well, it came out in the middle of a larger war in the 1980s to redefine the 1960s. Ronald Reagan was very focused on this. I mean, Ronald Reagan was an anti-60s culture warrior in the 1960s as the governor of California berating the hippies and the protesters at Berkeley. And he carried that forward into the 1980s, constantly making reference to going back to a more idyllic time, a time before the 1960s. And Family Ties, most of the comedy pivoted off of Alex, the kind of aspiring yuppie, making fun of his parents' 60s idealism as either unrealistic or outdated.
Alex, don't you ever worry about the fact that there are enough bombs in the world to destroy every living creature and wipe out life as we know it?
Hey, I got bigger things on my mind. Can I use the business section here, Mom?
Thanks.
Maybe we can just tell Matt he's one of the neighbor children.
It's just so predictable, that's all. Every time one of these ex-hippies comes prancing in from yesteryear, we gotta get out the love beads. Put on the ponchos. Pretend we care about people. I'm just a little too old for that stuff.
And again, this was part of a larger narrative in the culture, everything from the Big Chill to news outlets portraying the 60s in documentaries as sort of just a ridiculous time of unrealistic decadence among the hippies, magazine covers asking, when are we going to get over the 60s? And there's a political message involved in that, right? The political message is that all of the progress, the political progress, the liberal political progress that came out of the 1960s is something that was supposedly bad. And this was happening at the same time that the 1950s were being glorified as an ideal, that what was written out of the 80s version of the 50s, which still sticks with us today, is that the 50s wasn't a time of racial inequality, it wasn't a time of gender inequality, it wasn't a time of religious bigotry, it was supposedly just a time of great national unity. These themes, the bad 60s and the good 1950s, which are really the 80s version of the 50s and the 80s version of the 60s, still define our politics very much today. You see Tea Partiers today say that we should go back to the 1950s because things were better than that. And every presidential election that comes along, the Democrats are berated as supposedly too close to the 60s liberalism and 60s protesters.
So getting back to the popular culture of the 80s, we've talked about Family Ties, this hugely popular sitcom would seem to have had kind of conservative values. Were the writers and producers of Family Ties conservatives? I mean, were their politics conservative?
No, not at all. In fact, Gary David Goldberg, who was the creator of the show, was himself a hippie. And I asked him about this, and he said, well, look, first you have to remember that it is true. It should be acknowledged that Alex was also being made fun of in some sense. But he also said that they didn't design it to berate the 60s. They designed it to meet the audience where the audience already was. There was a fascinating story he told me about how the show changed before it was actually launched for its first year, that they did a pilot or two. And the show was supposed to be about primarily about the parents, and the kids were kind of going to be side characters. And they showed it to an audience. By the way, the audience was an overflow audience from When Joanie Met Chachi, which is a Happy Days spinoff, which was all about glorifying the 50s. So this overflow audience responds mainly to Alex.
Now, another big cultural touchstone of the 80s was the A-Team. Mr. T, of course, still has some traction today. How do you read this culturally and politically?
Well, the A-Team fits into an entire genre of shows that portrayed the government as either inept or evil. You had the Dukes of Hazzard, you had all the detective shows, you had the shows about the cops going rogue against the inept police establishment. The A-Team was a distilled version of this, of all of these themes. And you think about the beginning of the A-Team, what it's saying to the audience. It's saying that first, our heroes are unduly incarcerated. They then promptly escape from a government that can't even do the basic job of incarcerating them. And they have to go out and solve society's problems where the government refuses to solve those problems or can't solve those problems. And the main enemy to evade in the A-Team is the government itself.
In 1972, a crack commando unit was sent to prison by a military court for a crime they didn't commit. These men promptly escaped from a maximum security stockade to the Los Angeles underground. Today, still wanted by the government, they survive as soldiers of fortune. If you have a problem, if no one else can help, and if you can find them, maybe you can hire the A-Team.
This all sounds funny, and it's not exactly a critically acclaimed show. And some people say, why don't you have a sense of entertainment? And I certainly do. Look, I love the A-Team. I watch the A-Team all the time. But remember, the A-Team was one of the most popular shows among preteens, kids age 2 to 11. And what I argue in the book is that regardless of the motive of the creators of the A-Team, the A-Team, the Dukes of Hazzard, so many of these shows were being delivered to children at a time that they were forming the stories through which they would see their world. And so it's not really a surprise that the children of the 80s who were told, hey, the government's inept and the government is evil in so many different media, the A-Team, the Dukes of Hazzard, Knight Rider, the Ghostbusters, it's not surprising that that same generation has grown up and been more amenable to the modern-day political argument that the government is either inept or evil.
You also mentioned the Ghostbusters as part of this phenomenon as well. I guess I hadn't thought of that as being an anti-government movie series, but I suppose it is in a way.
Again, think about what the story of the Ghostbusters is. There's basically a terrorist attack on New York City, an interdimensional terrorist attack by ghosts. The police and the military can't deal with it, and so they have to hire the private contractor.
Are you troubled by strange noises in the middle of the night?
Do you experience feelings of dread in your basement or attic?
Have you or any of your family ever seen a spook, specter, or ghost?
If the answer is yes, then don't wait another minute. Pick up your phone and call the professionals. Go, Ghostbusters! Our courteous and efficient staff is on call 24 hours a day to serve all your supernatural elimination needs.
We're ready to believe you!
The whole humor in the movie, or at least part of it, is that they're not only the private contractors, but they're for profit. I mean, Peter Venkman, half of his humor is about how much money they're going to make in doing this. And there are analogs to this, obviously, when you think about our reliance now on private contractors, on the idea that the private corporation can be the savior. In fact, there's a line in Ghostbusters, just a really powerful line, where at the beginning where they're starting out and they're working in the university and they get kicked out of the public university. And one of the Ghostbusters, or before they become the Ghostbusters, he said, you know, I like the public sector because I've worked in the private sector, and in the private sector they expect results. Well, what's the message there? That the public sector expects no results whatsoever. Everybody in the public sector is just lazy and doesn't expect results. And it's funny, but again, a generation that's brought up on these themes, it's not surprising that that same generation is more open to, for instance, the attack on public workers today. Not so surprising that that generation hasn't flinched as much when we hear that our wars are being primarily or in part run by private military contractors.
Now, there's another movie that was very big in the 80s, Wall Street, starring Michael Douglas. And it would seem that this would be a different story because it was very critical of the Michael Douglas character. I mean, famously, who said greed is good. And, it turned out he was corrupt, you know, trying to bilk people out of their money. What do you see the politics there?
Wall Street is really interesting because it tells us what the 80s had become by the time it came out toward the end of the 80s, that Wall Street was a commentary, Oliver Stone's commentary, lamenting the greed is good ethos. And that greed is good speech was based on an actual speech by Ivan Boesky, the investor.
Greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed, in all of its forms, greed for life, for money, For love, knowledge, has marked the upward surge of mankind, and greed, you mark my words, will not only save Teldar Paper, but that other malfunctioning corporation called the USA.
Michael Douglas, who played Gordon Gekko, said, you know, people would come up to me who were working on Wall Street in the 90s and in the 2000s and say how much they loved Gordon Gekko. And I'm paraphrasing here, but he said, you know, they would say that they loved the character, not that they loved the lament, but that they saw Gordon Gekko as a hero. And so out of the 1980s comes this idea, even in movies that are supposed to be concerned about this, criticizing this, is the idea of the American dream means greed is good. And this is substantiated, by the way, by empirical data. One data point that's just really telling, in the year-to-year survey of college freshmen that has been done for, I think, 30 years or so, at the beginning of the 1980s, most college freshmen said that they were going to college to develop a meaningful philosophy of life. By the end of the 1980s, the top goal of college students, when they said, why are you going to college, was to make a lot of money. And these numbers have stayed where they are all the way through to today since the 1980s. So there was a formative change in the 1980s in how we define the American dream. The American dream went from a middle-class dream to a dream of great wealth and the idea that greed is really good. The 1980s, when let's specifically talk about greed and money, the way we know we continue to tell ourselves that story is that that has been the basic parameters of our political debate even after the Wall Street meltdown. The Wall Street Reform Bill that was supposed to have changed Wall Street after the greed is good ethos basically drove our economy into the ground, the Wall Street Reform Bill basically stipulated that we can't really, or we shouldn't really, change that fundamental principle on Wall Street. It was a very, very weak bill, and the debate about it in Congress and throughout the country as well, we only want to tweak the system just a little bit after that principle of greed is good got us into such trouble. And so the lament of the book is that we need to start changing the stories that we started telling ourselves in the 1980s and that we keep telling ourselves today.
David Sirota is a radio journalist and political analyst. He's the author of Back to Our Future. Steve Paulson spoke with him. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Tim Fleming. If you want to hear this program again, check an author's name, or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website. It's ttbook.org. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program number 522A, Right Turn. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Veronica Rickert, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Steve Gotcher. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.